Hey!
Aloha, mud babies, pod people, and inhabitants of the planet Earth. It is I, your tiki leader, Steve Mudflat McGrew. Oh, I'm back. It's been too long. You know, I say this every time I go away. I come back, I go, oh, it's been too long. But yes, it has freaking been too long. I don't know why I can't do this every week. What is wrong with me? I have got to be more dedicated to this. And I don't even know if that's the right word. I guess it is dedicated because the girlfriend, Miss Thang, Janet, who does her podcast, Two Girls and a Bottle of Wine, she books guests weeks ahead of time. Oh, she's like months ahead of time for her Two Girls and a Bottle of Wine guest list. And I wait to the last minute and then I get somebody and then something falls apart and then they're not able to do it. And then something comes up in the news and I think, oh, that's not the right guest for this. I should wait and get such and such on and we can talk about the Bruce Jenner thing or we can talk about what's going on where is it right now? Baltimore. Sorry, Baltimore. And so I just get distracted. And then I was in Hong Kong. I probably should have done a podcast from Hong Kong. That's where I was last week. I went to Hong Kong to do some shows for the very first time. Very cool. Put that on your bucket list of things you should go and see and do before you die. I guess that is what a bucket list is. And make sure you do that. Hong Kong was so much fun. And then I went down to Texas to visit my parents. My dad's been sick. And so I actually thought about doing a podcast with my dad to get him to tell some stories about me, but he just wasn't feeling well enough to do it. So that blew that idea. And so it just days turned into weeks and weeks turned into, hey, I've got to do a podcast. And then I got a message from a pal, Dylan Brody, writer, comedian, actor, author, just all around excellent talent and good guy. We talked about coming on the podcast and I said, yes, let's do it tomorrow. So that's what I did. Sat down just a minute ago. I talked to Dylan and it was a great podcast. For anybody that wants to learn about stand-up, writing, performing, how to structure a one-man show, it's a wealth of entertainment knowledge. Dylan brings it to the show today. So I hope you enjoy it. I hope I didn't go too long without doing a podcast. I lost a few of you. Those that are listening, please share this with your friends and let's get them all back in the fold of Remasculate. All right. So let's do it. Here is today's guest, Dylan Brody. I am sitting here with the illustrious and gorgeous, because we're Skyping. I'm actually getting to see him here, Mr. Dylan Brody. Dylan, how are you today?
I am charming and delightful. I am handsome and popular. I am sadly the man that all women want to be and all men want to be with.
Oh, man. That is quite the introduction.
If you ask me a stock question, I will give you a stock answer. I cannot help it.
That's just the way it goes. Now, when you do stand up and an MC says to you, Mr. Brody, what would you like for your intro? What do you tell that guy?
It depends on circumstance. Usually I say, make sure you say humorist and storyteller rather than comic or comedian. Uh-huh. And I always say, make sure you only say my name once and it is the last thing you say.
Oh, don't you? Isn't it annoying when they go, Dylan Brody, the next guy we've got coming up is, and then they start going, oh, let me tell you about the drink specials real quick before I do bring up Dylan Brody.
What I hate is, and yes, it's awful, but what I hate is when they do, Dylan Brody's the next guy up. He's a comic and he's a humorist. He's a storyteller. He's been on whatever. His CDs are up through Stand Up Records. So give him a hand, because if you don't hold the name for the very last thing, the audience has no idea when it's time to applaud
at all.
But if you give all the right signals, if you just build up, you do all the credits first and then any personal commentary and then the name, they know when to applaud. That is instruction for every MC in the world. It should be credits. Mm-hmm. He's written for The Tonight Show. He's been on A&E's Comedy on the Road. And then any personal commentary. We met backstage. I think he's a very funny man. I've been enjoying his work for years. And then the name, ladies and gentlemen, Shmern Mahelmahe.
Shmern Mahelmahe, yes.
Shmern Mahelmahe, whoever the person is, you get the name last, and then the audience hears the build and gets to the name, and then they get to applaud the name, not your request for applause.
Yes, yes. Now, do you find that too many credits given by the MC is a good thing or a bad thing?
That entirely depends on circumstance. There are some shows where the audience needs to be educated to the fact that they should show the next person respect.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other shows where you just want to get the act up. It also largely depends on how entertaining and personable the MC is.
Yeah, because a lot of times I always feel like, you know, they want to give, like, what are your credits? And I'll just try to think of the very last thing that I did. Compared to, like, well, what am I going to say? Comedy on the Road? These people don't know what that is. Am I going to say Caroline's Comedy Hour? Yeah, you know what I mean? You start going, are my credits relevant to this audience right here?
That's the key, is to figure out what people are going to respond to. When I'm on the road, when I'm in what we in L.A. and New York call the flyover cities,
right?
I generally use... if it's a really hip club, has been on Mark Maron's WTF podcast, and so on. If I'm in a more conservative, less comedy hip sort of a club, then I use Has Written for The Tonight Show. But when I'm in L.A. or New York or Chicago or San Francisco, then it's all about is one of the few people that David Sedaris has invited to have open for him.
Oh, nice.
Because that gives me a level of intellectual credibility,
right,
that I'm looking for. But if I don't think anyone's going to know what that means, I'm not going to bother using it as a credit.
Right. Well, I have to say this next guy has listened to the Mark Maron podcast. That's the extent that I can do with.
Oh, I think that's an excellent credit.
I have listened to it, and I know about his cats.
There you go. That's yeah, Boomer lives.
My girlfriend and I went to see Mark. He was here in Denver not long ago when we were hanging out backstage, and Mark had a little bit of a Marcusode, and the girlfriend was like, "Do you think we should leave? And, you know, does he need to be alone?" I'm like, "No, you obviously don't know Mark. He's having a time right now."
I felt very bad. I did a show with him a couple of years ago now. At the Writers Guild, and before the show, he was talking about how he was feeling happy and he didn't know what to do with that, and it was making him uncomfortable. This was in the green room.
Yeah.
When I had a minute alone with him, I wanted to be encouraging and helpful to him, because one of the things that's been difficult for me over the years was knowing that I could evolve and change and let my act and my material and my work changed with me. I didn't have to hold on to elements of a persona that were no longer true to myself. So when I had a moment alone with him, I said, you know, Mark, you're allowed to be happy. You're allowed to outgrow your neuroses and not be depressive. I understand that it's part of your shtick, but you can move on. And I saw his eyes narrow and his back stiffen. And he said, is that what it is? It's part of my shtick.
Oh no,
I didn't mean to. And then he walked away and that conversation was over.
Yeah, but I liked hearing you say that you are able to any of us right now, you can grow and move on from what you've been doing in the past.
Oh yeah. And I think it's important that we do. You know, Louis C.K. talks about when he had been 15 years into comedy and realized he needed to stop doing an act he hated. When I was a road comic years ago, I was a heavy duty road comic and I was far left leaning machine gun political comedy.
Right. That's how I remember you.
Yeah. It's good to be remembered. I was pro marijuana during the drug war, long before anyone was talking about legalization. And I was at a very conservative time. And when Sam Kinison and Andrew Dice Clay, who I think of as the right-wing rebels. You know, they go on stage and they would, well, Sam doesn't anymore.
Right.
That would be icky. They would go on stage and they would seem to be cutting edge, leading figures in cultural change because they said fuck a lot.
Right.
But in fact, all of their politics were horribly regressive. Sam was all about blaming the gays for AIDS and blaming the poor for their poverty and so on. And Andrew was pretty much actively misogynist in his act. But because of the language they used, they seemed to be pushing the envelope somehow. And that was becoming very successful. And I was trying very hard to bring another point of view to comedy when it was not, I felt, being adequately expressed. And then when I quit smoking pot in the early 90s, I had no idea who I was. I couldn't go on stage being this guy that I wasn't anymore and feel true to myself. And I had to figure out, am I opposed to pot? No, I'm not. I'm not using it, though, so I can no longer be this angry stoner kid who's ranting about politics, which is sort of the persona I had taken on.
Uh-huh.
And I figured out who I could be that would still be interesting to people, that would be interesting to me, and where my jokes would come from under that circumstance.
So you had to find your whole new persona of what you were.
I had to find my whole new act. I have a problem with the term persona because it confuses people trying to become comics into thinking that they have to define themselves for the audience. I think the audience defines us. Our persona is what the audience perceives, not what we project. So ultimately, I didn't have to say, who am I going to make myself seem like in front of people? I had to figure out who I was.
Right.
And what I wanted to say.
Yeah. Now, I kind of feel the same way at one point in my career where I was basically tired of what I was doing and I was tired in the hotel room and I didn't really even feel like doing the show. So that night I went on stage, basically just let me do this, and I discovered a whole new me. It was like I talked like me. I didn't try to use a speech pattern like, hey, look, I'm a comic. You know,
good for you.
Yeah. And yeah. Then one day you realize that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to just be me sharing my thoughts and concepts. And it was a weird process. Awakening.
It's a process, learning who you are, learning how you do it. And nobody starts out their first day on stage being wholly themselves, because there's a lot of perception and fear and expectation that you need to get past, and it takes a long time to get past it.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about the 10,000 hours that it takes to become an expert at anything. And for a comic, if you're only starting out by working 10 or 20 minutes a night, it's hard to build up the 10,000 hours.
Yeah, yeah. Or the 5-minute guys, they just do new talent every week, but they're polishing that 5 minutes.
And never get beyond it. I know a year or so ago, I guess 2 years ago, when I was first getting ready to open for David Sedaris the first time, I had a particular story he wanted me to tell. And I wanted to make sure it was clean and tight and perfect. So I went out just to get workout time. I would go out to 2 or 3 open mics locally and show up, and they would go, "Oh, Dylan Brody's here." And I would say, "Can I grab 6 minutes?" And they would say, "Yeah." And I'd go do my 6 minutes and I'd leave. And there were people waiting for their open mic slot who were waiting for open mic slots 27 years ago when I moved to L.A.
They had not improved?
I didn't stay and watch them. I'm sure they improved. You can't do something for 26 years without improving. But they hadn't moved on from that stage in their career.
Yeah. Well, I've heard a lot of guys talk about, you know, they're polishing their act. And if you see them over and over again, I'm polishing. Well, shit is shit. And sometimes now you just have shiny, polished poop. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's like you didn't really work on it. You just kept going back up and going, I'm waiting to be discovered. And this is my 5-10 minutes.
Oh, this is one of the great myths of show business. I talk about this all the time, the being discovered nonsense. It does not. That would require that there be people in the world who are out looking for other people to discover.
Yes.
It's mythology, and it's not helpful for us to keep buying into the mythologies of show business. We are in show business. The lost message of every fairy tale ever written, ever read, ever told is this. Nobody gets to be happy. Nobody gets to live happily ever after until all the illusions are shattered and everybody is disenchanted.
And that's what Hollywood does for you right there. Well, that's exactly what it does. You're the – like, well, I am the star here. I'm going to go to L.A. Dream shattered.
The glamour – again, going back to the fairy tale metaphor, glamour is always a lie. It's always an illusion cast by someone who is trying to distract a hero from their quest. And if your quest is to make a living as an artist and you go seeking the glamour – you've already missed the point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's all about finding our own voices, doing our own work, and finding our own audiences. Or else we are waiting for someone else to give us permission to be who we dream of being.
Now, did you find, as you've grown as an artist, did you find that moving...
Thank you for believing that I've grown as an artist.
Oh, of course you have. Of course you have. You're no longer the stoner fighting for the rights of the stoned. But
I'm still fighting for the rights of the stoned. I'm fighting for the rights of everybody, but I'm not stoned while I'm doing it.
Oh, okay. But as you move from clubs to bigger venues and working for bigger things, don't you find that finding your fans makes it easier to find your voice? Instead of just going to a club that says, hey, we have a comic every week, to being where a venue where they're – it doesn't matter if there's only 100 to 200 that are coming to see you. They're coming to see you.
Absolutely right. Finding your own audience makes it easier to find your voice and makes it easier to be free with who you are. When I was doing the road and being a road comic – it used to make my mother crazy that I dropped the G's from my ING words. I was trying to present as sort of a blue collar. I'm not overly educated. I'm just like you guys.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to talk about some things that are going on in my life right now, and I'm going to be fast about it, and I'm going to be funnier than anyone else in the room, but I'm going to try to be as accessible and as normal a human being as I possibly can. And it worked very well for me, but as I find an audience that doesn't mind the fact that I'm incredibly pompous,
uh-huh.
that I'm not just self-absorbed, I am hyper-educated, I am literate and literary, and some of my references are esoteric. I find that the more the audience is people who accept that in me, the more I am able to be who I am and let myself be seen as I am.
Right.
As opposed to pretending to be something for the sake of accessibility.
Well, you don't miss saying rockin' instead of rocking?
Sometimes I do miss it. I don't miss it most of the time. There are times I drift back and forth into it. It's code switching.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's the thing that angry right-wing white people complain about when blacks slide into Ebonics with their own family.
Yeah, it's kind of like when I go home to Texas, and the next thing I know, I'm talking like the Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah, my wife's family lives in Georgia, and when we go home, she has an accent for 2 weeks afterwards when we come back.
Uh huh.
It's natural code switching that goes on with everybody all the time. How do I best relate to the people around me? I'm not a big character guy. I am not Maria Bamford.
Oh.
We get mistaken for one another all the time.
I can see the resemblance. Uh-huh.
But I am not Maria Bamford. I don't do 112 different fully developed characters. But I do occasionally slip in and out of different aspects of myself. And it's nice to have the blue-collar guy who can have a point of view on things for me to agree with or counter.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing wrong with setting up a straw man when you want to have an argument you can win. But I'm so happy not to have to be that guy all the damn time anymore.
What got you into comedy originally? When you were younger, what made you go, I think I would like to go on stage in front of strangers and hopefully not embarrass myself?
I always knew this was what I wanted to do. Watching George Carlin on television when I was a child, I knew that's what I want to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I grew up in upstate New York, a town called Schuylerville, New York. My dad was teaching at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, very nearby. And whenever someone in the Skidmore College theater department needed a kid in a play, they would call my father and say, hey, is your son available?
Uh-huh.
And then I would, you know, have to leave school to go to rehearsal at college when I was 9 and 10, and then back to school in the morning. And I have this very clear memory. I had to be maybe 10 or 11. My dad was late picking me up after rehearsal, and all the college students had gone off to their classes or their dorm rooms or whatever the hell they were doing. And the head of the theater department had to leave. My father was not yet the head of the theater department at that time. So I was left alone in the theater to wait for my dad. And I stood on stage and performed to the empty room. In my mind, it was beautiful.
Oh, you're killing.
I have no idea what material I did. I don't know if I did stolen George Carlin material, or if I was improvising, or if I was doing jokes I had written in school. I don't know what I did, but I remember the feeling of standing on stage and imagining the audience.
Right.
And just talking to them. And when my father got there, I had stopped. And I remember the silence in the car on the drive home and him saying, what are you thinking about? And me saying, nothing. And that was a lie. And my face pressed against the cold glass of the window beside me, watching the posts at the side of the road slip past, and remembering the sensation of being on stage in front of an audience that I had imagined an hour earlier, but that was now entirely real and realized in my mind and my memory.
You were performing to a packed house.
Oh, sure. I was a draw, baby. When I was 11, you could count on me to fill a room. I just realized never in the fantasy. In the fantasies, one is never walking the room, are they? That only comes later when you're feeling very full of yourself.
Well, now that you mentioned that, let me ask you a question about that. Because I see a perception today of a lot of comics that think if you walk a room, you are brilliant.
That perception's been around for a long time. Kinison was doing that. Kinison was very proud of the rooms he had walked. And there is, to some degree, a validity and a self-validation that comes with the willingness to say, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'm talking about. If you don't like it, you can leave. And I think it's important that artists of all stripes have a willingness to go places that make people uncomfortable, that are not pandering to the lowest common denominator, and so on. I also think it shouldn't be the goal. When I was starting out in New York in the very early 80s, Gilbert Gottfried was working Catch a Rising Star. And if it wasn't going his way, he would turn to the brick wall behind him and say, rest of the act I'm doing about this brick, not the whole wall, just this brick right here. And then he would drive him into the ground and see if he could get him to walk out. Andy Kaufman, I think, really started it. He was the one who would, mm-hmm. if it wasn't going well, he would be War and Peace until they were angry.
Now that's just considered performance art, though, isn't it? If it becomes, when does like, isn't there a line between where stand up itself just becomes a completely different art form? Because that's what I think.
It's not a clear line, but yeah, there's a line. There's a line between, and it's an ever shifting line. The reason I call myself a humorist and storyteller rather than a comic or a comedian isn't that I'm not funny. It's that I don't insist on being funny every 15 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And in the late 50s, early 60s, I would have been a comic. earlier than that. Lord Buckley was doing stuff that was long form Shakespeare and biblical stories that he would tell and then tell again in the jive vernacular of the time. And that was considered comedy. But sometimes with all these, with Bob Newhart, with Bill Cosby, you know, in his earlier, less rapey stuff, with a lot of comics, with George Gobel, there would be storytelling that took you somewhere before the laugh.
Yes.
And that was accepted. With the advent of the cable channels and the comedy boom of the late 80s, early 90s, with all the showcase programs that were on in the late 80s, early 90s, and the late night talk shows that were for a while exposing a lot of comics, in 6 minutes, you had to get the maximum number of laughs. And it became unspoken rule, and now spoken rule. If you talk to The Tonight Show about getting booked, they say we need a 4-to-1 laugh per minute ratio.
That's pretty big.
They think about it with a stopwatch. Everything you say is set up for punchline, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to be getting a laugh every 15 seconds, which is fine, but is not the only thing available in the humor scape.
Right.
And if I say I'm a comic and then I don't get that ratio, people are disappointed. If I say I'm a humorous storyteller, if I say has opened for David Sedaris, if I say spoken word artist, people can come with me on long, dark, convoluted linguistic journeys, and then the laugh can be explosive and unexpected.
Right. I've had a couple of people talking to me lately about doing a one-man show, so kind of like moving up to a longer version show. And they said one of the things you'll appreciate about doing that is the laugh per minute ratio, that theater people are a little more forgiving than club people, that they're there for an evening and not just a, hey, make me laugh, you bastard.
And the beauty of – there's a couple of things that are beautiful about doing solo shows. And let me take a second here to say this Sunday, that is to say May 3rd, at the Improv on Melrose at 6 p.m., I am presenting all the material that will be my next solo show. Eventually, Eve Bradstein is going to be directing it as a theatrical piece. It'll have a little more staging. But right now, it's just me, you know, storytelling.
Yes.
And it's $5. It's $5 at the door for an hour 12 of me telling beautiful stories.
Oh, you can't beat that again. What was the date again?
This Sunday, May 3rd, at the Improv at 6 p.m.
At the Melrose Improv.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Now, one of the glorious things about the solo show, two of the glorious things, three glorious things. first of all, you have that freedom from the 4-to-1 LPM. Secondly, you have the room to create a longer arc. You can tell a story. You can get plenty of laughs, however many you want. But because it is a theatrical experience, one is expected to create a build and a climax and a denouement that is far more satisfying than any fast laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, because you're working in a theatrical environment much of the time, the audience isn't drunk, which means they can follow a long thought.
Yeah.
It's not just that you don't get the hecklers and you don't get the table chatter and you don't get the table in the front with the girls at a bachelorette party who think the evening is about them. It's not just that, although, boy, is that lovely not to have to deal with. But it's that once people start drinking, their ability to hold an idea, to follow a convoluted sentence structure or a complex set of ideas that are going to add up to something bigger is diminished with each sip they take.
Mm-hmm.
So by the end of the evening, you have to be doing a 4-to-1 LPM if they're drunk, or they can't figure out why you haven't been funny.
Right.
With a really drunk crowd, when you're headlining a show in a club, sometimes I will have a 2-sentence instead of a 1-sentence setup. And someone starts muttering critique at me.
Get to the point. Get to the point.
Get to the joke. Where's the joke? Because they think it's my failing that they can't think straight.
Yeah.
And in a theater, that doesn't happen.
Now, walk us through, or walk me through, or the listeners through, when you decide to do a one-man show, okay, you got, do you come up with, is it a theme first, an idea first, or do you already have jokes and go, okay, now how do I structure this into a one-man show?
I am a ridiculously prolific writer. So I'm constantly writing new stories and new pieces and pilots and screenplays and other things that nobody ever buys. So I've always got new stuff that's coming out of me. Well, that just sounds gross. That's fluid.
Get that check. that's what depends are for.
Here's a quick tip on cell phone etiquette. It's okay to talk loudly in a restaurant about your son's honorable discharge.
Right.
It's not okay to talk about his oozing discharge.
Yeah.
My first solo show was it was called More Arts, Less Marshall, available as a $5 download at Rooftop Comedy. More Arts, Less Marshall, and it was all of my martial arts related stories, and it all led up to me taking the audience on a guided meditation with which I close classes when I'm teaching martial arts. Now, I already had in my repertoire a story about my bullied childhood and how I brought that into adulthood. The story about how I started studying martial arts. A couple of stories about key lessons I had picked up over the training. And it was this meditation that I wanted to find a way to put on stage that I knew I wanted to close with. I put all of those in order, found new callbacks that ran between them, figured out how to build a little bit of an arc to get me to what I was trying to get to with the thing, found out that it only ran 52 minutes, and wrote another small story to go into it. And I was good to go.
You hit one. Did it hit 1 hour? Is that what you?
When I do it live, it runs about 1 hour 20. The $5 download available at Rooftop Comedy is just under 1 hour. Here's a funny story. I hope when I went to record the show, I had hired a video crew to come out to the fake gallery where I was performing the show, and it was a 4-camera shoot. Very low. We didn't have booms and stuff. You know, it wasn't a camera moving in on me and that kind of thing. It was just, you know, 4 cameras, intimate setting. I wanted to feel a little bit Spalding Gray, intimate in a small space. And I paid a few thousand dollars for the camera crew and the director and so on. And they set up all the cameras, and the audio guy mic'd me with a lavalier mic. And as I was about to go on, I said, all right, show runs about 1 hour 20. So make sure you get plenty of coverage, you know, keep all the cameras rolling. And the director said, whoa, we only have 1 hour on the chips.
Oh.
And I said, what? And camera chips, they only hold 1 hour. And I said, okay. And as I'm saying this, they're saying, and now, ladies and gentlemen, Dylan Brody. And I went on stage and edited on the fly in my head. So I cut one story out of the show and then realized there was a callback that wasn't going to work later, and added the setup to another story and got it back in later on. Like, I was doing all this extra mental gymnastics to make the thing fit under 1 hour as I was performing, which I think in some ways made it a better performance because it really forced me to be wholly in the moment.
Tighten it. You're tightening it.
Exactly. So that one runs just under 1 hour if you downloaded it, about 1 hour 20 when I perform it live. The new one that I'm working on, I had this weird experience. Eve Brandstein, who is a wonderful director and whose work I love, she produces a series called Poetry in Motion here in town, sometimes in New York, said, I would like to direct your next solo show. And I said, I'll think about it because I'm an asshole. And She had to do just an evening, a poetry in motion evening on my own that went very well. We recorded a bunch of stories that I really wanted to get down on audio and some poetry. All will be available through Rooftop Media and audible.com. Afterwards, she said, oh, this was wonderful. I'd really like to direct a solo show for you. And I said, I don't know, because I was still an asshole. And then a producer that I know said, I hear Eve Bradstein wants to do something with you. I'd like to produce that show. I don't know, because as I may have mentioned, I am an asshole. And then in therapy, I had this moment of realization. You wait around, you get caught up in that mythology we were talking about earlier about being discovered.
Right.
And somebody says, I really want to work with you on something. I want to help you get this to a bigger audience. I want to help you develop it to the next level. And you don't realize that that's what it looks like, because it's not what you imagined being discovered looks like.
Yeah, you're supposed to be just plucked out of obscurity and placed in stardom.
Yeah. So I called her and I said, let's do this. I'm sorry I'm an idiot. Let's do this. And I proposed my next solo show. And again, I had a theme I wanted to work with that was going to make my life easy. There's an improvisational structure I do where I take two sentences from an audience and then I present lost theatrical monologues that I improvise, all of which begin and end with those two sentences. So I'll do whatever those sentences are. It turns out that David Mamet and Tennessee Williams and William Shakespeare all wrote monologues that started with one of those sentences and ended with the other. And then I do those monologues. And it's a parlor trick. It's improv, and it's funny, and it's incredibly smart.
And I would love to see that. And is that somewhere?
If you go online and you find on YouTube, look for Dylan Brody Improvises.
Okay.
And there are a couple of them. My favorite one is Dylan Brody Improvises at MIT. I was honoring my father. So that night I did plays by Mamet and Shakespeare and my dad. Which was very cool. But the one in the style of my dad makes no sense to anybody except my dad, although it's a great monologue. So, you can find those. But the show, I was going to call the show The Lost Monologues, and I would tell all of my stories about my theatrical training and theatrical experience to lead up to that piece at the end. And I took it to Eve and said, oh, this sounds interesting, yes. And then when I was going to come in with her to pitch it to the woman who wanted to produce, she said, can you come up with something that's a little more Spalding Gray, a little heavier? And I said, sure. And I hung up. And I realized that I was trying to make my life easy with that first idea, as opposed to really pushing the limits of what I can and want to do. And that she was giving me permission to push things further.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided I wanted to do a piece about the nature of art as opposed to entertainment. The difficulty we have as artists in a world of commerce. And I took all of those stories that relate to that and put them together and created some new stuff and gave it a spine and so on. And I took it in and I presented it to them and they said, let's do a run of this. And I did a one night presentation of what I had written. And I filled a small coffee house with audience and ran this thing. And it's terrific, but it was really a downer. It was funny, 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 bleak, bleak.
And you walk
and
out,
I'm done.
And you walk out depressed.
And afterwards, Eve said, this is terrific. Can you make it a little more not miserable by the end? And, you know, the part of me that would like to walk rooms if they don't agree with me went, fuck you. I don't need to do any rewrites. But what I actually said aloud was, yeah, sure. And then I challenged myself to find a way to say what I wanted to say without being miserable about it. I wanted to not compromise the idea of the piece, but I also wanted to make it viable as a production. And I did a rewrite that is what you can see this Sunday at the Improv at 6 p.m., $5 at the door, May 3rd. I did this rewrite that is so funny and so moving, and I have never been more proud of any work that I have ever done than of what I'm presenting this weekend.
Now, do you write this out as an actual script? Do you do it as a story, or do you have because you know, like for comics, as we do, you kind of just take an idea on stage and form it on stage. Like, I don't even sit at a computer half the time to write my punchline. I have the idea, and the joke comes out when you're on stage because you're in that funny moment.
I have never been that guy.
You've never been that guy.
So occasionally, if I'm on stage and I'm talking about a thing, I'm doing material, and I'm living in the moment, I will occasionally write a joke on stage, but I never plan to. If I'm going to take something on stage, I have my material on it. At least I have my central punchlines.
Right.
If I'm doing comedy, if I'm doing storytelling, it's a different thing. It's not about punchlines. It's about images and words and sentences and occasional punchlines.
So it's written out as a script then to you.
First of all, I write them out as scripts, but I don't make myself stick to them. Here's how I prepare a new story.
Okay.
When I'm taking a story out, I write it generally. It's not always the case, but I write the story as cleanly and clearly as I can on the page at the computer. And then I have a list of people who will let me call them to rehearse. And I call the first five on the list and I read them the story. And I make changes in pen as I go. This sentence is impossible to get out on one breath. I need to get a laugh in here somewhere. The audience is going to get, you know, those sorts of notes.
Yeah.
After those five, the next five I do with the script near me, but I just tell them the story, knowing that I can glance at the script if I need to know what comes next. And after each of those calls, I go through the script to see if there are any important images or phrases or sentences or jokes that I want to get in that I left out. And I mark those and I figure out why I left them out and how I can remember to keep them in. The next five or seven that I do on the phone, I don't let myself look at the script at all until after I've performed on the phone. I do the thing for them. I say, thank you. I hang up. I check the script. By the end of that process in a day, I've got it committed to memory.
Well, that's pretty good memory then.
Oh yeah. No problem. And then I've made some changes. I've done some rewrites. I've done clarifications. I've done cleanup. And then when I take it out on stage, I allow myself every freedom in the world to screw it up. I'm not worried about getting it right. There's a line in one of my father's plays. There's a singer from pre-war Germany who has moved to the U.S. and has old heavy wax discs of her singing, and someone listens to one and says, it's incredible, it's beautiful. And she says, it's not my best performance. When you're recording, you're too worried about doing it right to do it well.
Not the truth.
And so when I perform, when I record, even I make it a habit to do the work instead of worrying about doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
On every one of my CDs, five CDs available from Stand Up Records, one full-length digital download, Dylan Goes Electric, available from Rooftop Comedy, you will find there are places on my CDs where I am way off script, where I am talking about somebody who walked around the room loudly during the show, or dealing with the fact that I just blurted something out that I'm not sure I want to have on the CD. I'm always trying to stay in the moment and open to things that happen live so that I don't get caught up in trying to reproduce something I've done before, because that's just deadly to art.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, do you consider yourself, because I'm as I'm listening to this and talking to hearing you talk about performance, do you consider yourself like an actor at times on stage, or you just could still Do you see what I'm saying? Because you're talking about doing these performance pieces that you've written, these stories. So to me, I would have to in my head, I'm hearing I would have to look at the script, figure out how I'm going to act this out to the audience instead of delivering jokes.
I'm a trained actor. I went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. I have acting training. But ultimately, acting is not about figuring out how you're going to act something out. Acting is about finding out how using the words created by a playwright, if it's, you know, that kind of acting, mm-hmm. right? Using the words created by the playwright or the screenwriter or what have you, how am I going to remain entirely in the moment, responding to how do I throw myself into the belief of that reality so thoroughly that I can be alive in it and allow that to happen naturally? How do I allow myself to hear the incoming information from my acting partner and respond with the words at hand? In stand-up, the acting partner is the audience. And because you've never thought of it as performance, which it is,
right,
it never occurred to you that what you are doing is putting yourself in the mindset that lets you react in the moment live to an audience with your next thought. And how much that thought is predetermined by something that is written in advance is simply a matter of degree.
In what way? And that you mean that you, the way you're going to deliver that line is because how they've been responding to you?
To some degree, yes. Listen, in a conversation, I don't know how long I'm going to wait before I talk next. Because I haven't timed each of the things you're going to say
mm-hmm.
so that I know. Now I will pause for 3.2 seconds and adjust my eyebrows and then respond.
Because that's what the script calls for.
Yeah. No. There was a moment when I was studying it at the Royal Academy, in fact, because I worked very naturalistically as an actor, and the British system was very different from what I do. My Shakespeare teachers at one point saw an Iago monologue that I was doing and liked the monologue a lot, and then said, but it would be lovely if when you talk about hiding the handkerchief within the tent, you were to raise your left eyebrow on that line. And I said, there's no possible way I can act while my eyebrows are keeping appointments. because when you're performing on stage, that's right. When you're performing on stage, I am sure that if the audience laughs for a long time at a joke that doesn't usually get that big a laugh, you are capable of hearing that laughter and waiting till the right moment to speak again, as opposed to maintaining the same rhythm you always have, regardless of their rhythm.
Right. I always try to do my stand-up. I just got back from Hong Kong. I just did a bunch of shows in Hong Kong.
Ooh, congratulations.
Thank you. It was my first time there. It was kind of exciting. But I was talking to some of them about how my timing was different because I wasn't used to the audience. And it kind of dawned on me while I was talking to them that I do stand-up much like surfing, that I ride the wave. Like I totally pay attention to what is happening. Is this a big wave? Is it a little wave? How long do I – but I write it exactly the same way.
That's what all of acting is. It's staying in that moment and feeling what this moment is taking me to next, responding organically and authentically to what's happening. And then, you know, with a play or a film – or TV, where it's with any scripted dialogue format, the actor's job is in rehearsal to find out what the least necessary control is that one has to have in order to get to that next beat organically. For me, that all comes from listening to the other performers and knowing what it is that I need to hear in their performance to get me to the next thing.
Which makes it very difficult from what you're saying, and people that will hear this and have acted will know, if you've ever auditioned with a horrible, horrible casting person, it's so hard to get a good performance because you're performing to somebody looking at a piece of paper and reading the lines and not acting with you.
The secret for me in that, and this is a weird little mental trick that I play on myself that I share with you and all of your listeners free of charge.
Thank you.
I'm not getting paid for this, am I?
No, but you will. Could they show up your show?
Excellent.
At the Improv.
I offer this to you and your audience, your listening audience, free of charge. For that sort of audition circumstance, I make certain that what I need to hear is specific to the words, and not to the relationship, because you can't count on a casting director to act or a casting assistant to act when they're reading. So I simply put myself in a world where I am the only person who is not a monotonous bore. And I assume that I function in this world by responding to what I, to the specific words I hear, not inflection, not human interaction, just the words. And by putting myself in that world, I am able to be the human being in the dialogue who is listening and responding, even though I'm not getting a full spectrum of stimuli to which to respond.
Right. Now, I read years ago that the actor Michael Madsen, which you know from Reservoir Dogs and a bunch of stuff, he said that he can't audition, that he doesn't do it well, and that they have to hire him. And part of his acting technique was when you get into character, like when he did the movie Tombstone. He goes, when you put on the costume, it's you're play acting. You know what you're supposed to do. Which makes so much sense. It's like if you want me, just hire me. Tell me what to do. Because that's what my acting teacher told me that one time. He told me, he goes, you take direction very well. And I'm like, basically, isn't that what we're all doing? We're just going to be told, bring it down, bring it up, say this, give me 30% more.
Every director is different. Every actor is different. Some directors expect you to make all of your decisions on your own, and they will. I once saw Christopher Walken on set during the shooting of a film called Communion years ago, and they did the master shot. They did three or four takes of the master shot, which is the master shot is the big shot that has all of the actors in it and the overview of the scene.
Right.
They come in for the close-ups on each of the actors, and me and then you and then me and then you. And he gave entirely different performances in each take from the master shot. And I was watching, go, oh, Jesus, how are they going to edit this together and make sense of it? And then they came in for his close-ups, and he gave exactly the same different performances. And then they went to the over-the-shoulder, and he gave exactly the same different performances. And what he was saying without saying it was, choose one of these and you've got a consistent performance.
Right.
I don't care one, but you don't get to chop up and pull out pieces of different performances and create something I didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And it was beautiful to watch. Other actors want a lot of direction and want to give a lot of different options for them to cut together however they want. Lorraine Newman will not audition, or at least she doesn't like to. She's brilliant. Everything I've ever seen her do has been absolutely wonderful. But auditioning bugs the crap out of her. I don't blame her.
Yeah.
There's a moment in the new piece, Dylan Brody's Driving Hollywood, this Sunday, May 3rd at 6 p.m. at the Improv, $5 at the door. I talk about the cruelest trick that Hollywood plays on people is after the audition. Because you go into an audition and you're sitting in a room with people who don't fully understand how you do what you do as an artist. And you reach into the gaping wound of your wit and you pull out what glistening gems you may find. And you display them on a table in front of them. And you present as fully confident and wholly comfortable with what you do, so that they can feel fully confident and comfortable hiring you. And then you are either rejected or told to go home and wait to find out whether you are going to be rejected. And then you are forced to go out to an assistant or a receptionist and verbalize the exact subtext you have been trying not to express for the last hour. You have to say, will you validate me?
Yeah.
I need validation.
At least my parking.
Yeah, it's just, it's horrible.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I hated for a while back in the early 90s, mid 90s. I was signed with APA and had the manager and was sort of like the flavor.
Danny Robinson?
Yeah, Danny, yeah.
He's coming to my show on Saturday.
Well, tell him hi for me.
At 6 at the Improv.
And so I sort of remember being the flavor of the month by doing all of the rounds and all the meetings, and I had sold a script to Disney, and I was doing all those general meetings, and it was soul crushing because it really was. I mean, whether they wanted. it was just, it was, uh-oh, are you still there?
You went on hold for a moment. You said it was soul crushing.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
And then you put me on hold.
Yeah. Somebody started to dial my phone. I apologize. I will edit that. Okay. Because they want to meet you, but at the same time, they're like, now when you go in there, you blow them away. You go in there and you just do what I go, no, what I do is on stage. I'm not generally. You know how comics are. We don't walk around cracking jokes. We're not all Robin Williams all day long.
We do if we're annoying.
Yes. Yeah. And so you felt like, what am I supposed to – did I not dazzle them enough in that little five-minute meeting?
I heard a great Robin Williams story from his manager. I did a memorial tribute to him shortly after he died. And his manager told a wonderful story about before Mork and Mindy, before Happy Days, he sent him out on an audition. He had great confidence in Robin's work, and Robin went to the audition and he called in and said, I don't know how that went. And he said, all right, well, I'll let you know. And then the casting director called and said, we looked at that Robin Williams guy. And the manager said, oh, yeah, how'd it go? And he said, we told you we needed an American. Said, well, what? Why are you sending this Welsh guy with a thick accent? Welsh? What are you talking about? The Robin Williams guy you sent us. Have you never met your own client? What is wrong with you? And he called Robin and said, did you go in with a Welsh accent? He said, yeah, I thought it would be good if the character was Welsh. So you went in with a Welsh accent and then you performed with a Welsh accent. Yeah, well, yeah, I didn't, you know, I wanted to just think I was being myself.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing that's so hard for an actor or anybody too, because they tell you, make a choice and stick with it when you go into audition. You don't have any billions of choices there is, and how do you know that's the right one?
Oh, you can't. I think it's Jeffrey Tambor who talks about this. I may be getting that wrong. There's an actor and acting teacher in town who talks about the fact that you go in, you say, this is what I offer. If it's what you want, use it. If it's not, go a different way. And you have to be confident enough in what you do that if you don't get a job, it doesn't feel as though you did it wrong. It's just that you're not the guy they're looking for.
Yeah.
And it's pretty hard not to take it all personally. Do you know why? Because we're people.
Exactly.
But ultimately, because of the nature of entertainment in a society of commerce, we are also product.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be willing to accept that not everybody wants the same product. And it's very difficult to not feel hurt and crushed every time we're not the product they want.
Well, it also can be that you look like the boyfriend she just broke up with last night. You could be, you know, any of that goes into account when a casting director is looking at you.
Yeah, you have no idea what causes the decisions to be made that are made. And ultimately, that's why we can't wait to be discovered. We have to be constantly building our own work, finding our own way, creating our own destiny and our own careers. And then when things come along where we are of service to someone else's project, we step into those roles and we become something else for a minute.
I want to ask you a question about on the writing, when you're writing.
I think my contract writer said there would be no questions.
Oh, okay. Well,
go ahead.
When you know that material that you've done in the past, like the things that you've recorded, you know they're good. You know they work. And now it's time for the next stuff. You start writing. How do you know, or in your head, do you feel as equally happy with the new material? Because I find myself a lot of times like I'm writing new stuff. Like I've been working on a new hour right now. I'm happy with about 40 of it. But I still don't feel that it's totally as great as some of the old stuff. So is it an impersonal thing that you go, no, this is good, this is just as good, or do you keep writing?
First of all, I know when a joke is going to work. When I write a joke, I know if it works or not. I don't know how I know, but I understand how a joke functions. I have faith that my work will always be good. it won't all be equally good. But on my worst day, a story I write on my worst day is going to be better than what most people write on their best day.
Okay.
Just 'cause I've been doing it long enough.
Right.
And I know what I'm doing. I know how to structure a story. I know how to make good sentences. I know how to make well sentences. I know how well to.
You make them gooder than other people.
This is what I'm saying.
Yes.
Thank you. I know that I will write something that will be of quality. It may not be of my highest quality, but it will be of quality. So I'm unworried about that. I've learned over the years that sometimes the things I like most are not the things that another person likes most. So a thing that I like least may be the thing that someone else will really latch onto and say, oh, this is genius. And that's fine. That doesn't hurt me in any way. I just have faith that I know what I'm doing and the work will be good enough, because there's no right or wrong when it comes to art and creativity. There is just done or not.
Yeah. So it doesn't – for me, a lot of times – and it's come listening to older albums and other bands and stuff where you go, well, you know, their last album was so much better. Their last and I kind of feel that a lot of times when I listen to comedy albums. You go, well, you know, I really liked their last one better. So I feel – I have that same fear for myself that people go, yeah, you know, I think he's lost it. I think we liked his last one so much better.
Decide what you want to do and what you want to say, and each one will be different. And none of them will be your last.
Just keep doing it.
Yeah. And there will be people who will like the one that you like least the most. And there will be people who like the one that you like most the least. And there will be people who really prefer Carrot Top.
Sorry, that choked me up. But you're right. That's exactly what
– You know, you can't control what people like or don't like. All you can control is your own work and the continuing of the effort. And for the record, you know, I have nothing against Carrot Top, although I don't enjoy his album at all.
It's too visual. It didn't work on the album.
Make any sense at all.
Right.
A beer can for a moose. I don't understand why that's funny.
You have to be there. It's in the moment is what I'm told. You actually have to be hit by a laser light at the exact moment that punchline is delivered.
I didn't know.
Yeah. So where do you find your inspiration? Are you an everyday kind of guy, a topical, what's happening in the news, or stories come from things that you remember from the past?
I used to be all topical when I was a road comic. Now when I have stuff that I want to say about what's going on in the news, I put it in Huffington Post, I put it in Daily Kos, I put it online, and if I can be funny in it, that's fine, but I don't push myself to. Most of my stories now, most of my performance now, come largely from the past, from my history, from my memory. I deal a lot with the nature of memory and the way memory works and the way personal change and evolution occurs. But there are also stories that are heavily political without acknowledging that that's what I'm doing. I have a piece called Democracy 101. I think it's on the album True Enough, Stand Up Records 2010, available at Amazon.com. You can actually just buy that track. Democracy 101 deals with the problems that I see in the way we run a democracy in this country. There's one... I don't even remember what the title of the track is, but there's a story about going to score grass in Hollywood for a friend of mine after I had quit smoking. And it weirdly is all about the false dichotomy of red and blue and Republican and Democrat and Crips and Bloods, and the idea that we have this this subconscious assumption of confrontational dynamic that is not necessary. But I don't say that anywhere in it. I tell a story about going to score grass and a dream that I had. And the points that I'm making are in the subtext and available to an audience that's listening.
Right.
So now when I want to get political in my performance work, because I can write political stuff when I need to, but when I want to get political in my performance work, as much as I can, The Secret Shame of the Casual Conspirator is all about the danger of censorship, and self-censorship. The ideas that I want to express, the complex political ideas, are presented through the personal story and the awareness. Can I tell you something weird that has nothing to do with what I'm saying?
Sure.
I can see a reflection of my hand in your glasses from your screen through my screen as I'm seeing it also in a little box on my screen. So I am having this meta experience of seeing a reflection of a projection of me in a faraway city that is an image that will show up in a story within the next year.
Oh my God. It's almost infinity.
It's really cool. Did you just put me, did you hang up on me?
No, there you are. You flip for some reason.
Well,
there it is
again.
That's weird. It's flipping.
I don't understand what's happening.
It's the infinity of the glass thing happening. When you brought it up, Skype went, oh crap, what is happening?
Oh no, he's on green screen. He doesn't exist. So I think ultimately, I think all art is political. I don't mean to screw with your audience by quoting Chairman Mao on your.
Mao!
But all art is political. And as I say in my new show, entertainment is the word that people use when they don't want to take responsibility for what they're saying through their art.
Yeah.
And I think any comic who says, hey, it's just a joke, is abrogating responsibility for using one of the most powerful linguistic tools in history.
Well, I just had a conversation with another comic the other day about the whole Bruce Jenner thing, that he watched the special and he said, after watching it, I feel sorry for him and I hope the best for him, and I'm just not going to make jokes about it. And I go, well, now – how is that helping your comedy form? Yes, we all feel it's bad and hope the best for him, but isn't you the part of a comic that we don't censor ourselves in any way, shape, or form?
Well, I think quite the opposite, actually. I think if he feels that there is a reason to feel sorry for Bruce Jenner, if he feels that there is material there that is of emotional content for him, and that there is a treatment of Jenner that needs protection, I think there's material to be written in that. When I was, again, going back to when I was a road comic, it was very common for people to do fag material on stage. There was gay bashing all over the goddamn comedy world. People were so uncomfortable with homosexuality, and it was becoming commonplace to be aware of it publicly. That's bullshit. Lenny Bruce was doing jokes about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was somehow a point of terror for a large part of the population. It was the discussion of gays in the military was happening, and a lot of comics were just jumping on the gay bashing bandwagon because it is easy to make jokes based on stereotype. But every time you do, you reinforce a stereotype. I was going on stage and doing 7 to 12 minutes on how I feel that homophobia was the last accepted form of bigotry in the U.S. And I was speaking out for an awareness of humanity and shared humanity, which is more difficult to write jokes about. It's not an easy laugh.
True.
But I think it's a better representation of what I do and what I believe and what I think people should be thinking and believing with me. Now, if we say we should never censor ourselves in any way, does that mean that if I come up with a joke I disagree with, I am under some moral obligation to do it because to not do it would be self-censorship? I would say no. I'm not going to do a fag joke just because it could make people laugh. I would censor that from my act and replace it with something that makes the point that I want to make. I would say there is no topic that should be off the table. There is no idea that should be off the table.
I think that's the best point right there. I think that's probably what I was trying to get to him, was that no topic should be off the table. It's not. You just won't do it, or I won't do it.
If this guy thinks that Bruce Jenner is to be pitied, and he thinks that most people, and I don't know that they are, and I don't know that this is what he thinks, I'm just spitballing here, but if he thinks that Bruce Jenner is to be pitied and that most people will ostracize and ridicule him, then for God's sake, write 5 minutes about how Bruce Jenner is a fucking gutsy bastard. And you guys who sit with your friends who already agree with you and drink beer and talk about what a coward he is in your mom's basement are not gutsy bastards, then you're onto something.
Right.
And then you're onto something that you can believe in, and you're not censoring yourself. You're not saying, I won't touch that because he should be pitied. You're saying, why the hell do we need to pity people who do things that we're not necessarily comfortable with?
Yeah, they're actually maybe stronger than us.
And the material may actually become stronger as a result.
True, true. Now, let me ask you about a mutual acquaintance of ours, the Dylan Brody's neighbor's couch.
Ah, Darren Staley, yes.
Yeah. So how did that start with you guys? I was listening to his podcast, and as of now, I guess you guys aren't doing it.
Yeah, no, he stopped doing it a while ago. It's a wonderful story. I love that guy. When I first got on Twitter, Kelly Carlin and I and a few other people, Gary Shandling and Paul Myers, sort of started playing top that line. We were just playing hashtag games and being funny on Twitter, figuring out what this new social network of haiku length ideas was. And Darren Staley joined us. Prevenzo was part of the group. Darren Staley, Twitter handle at Crowbama, because Crow is his nickname for some reason.
He looks like a crow. That's what he told me.
Okay. And he's an Obama supporter.
Yeah.
Crowbama, at Crowbama. He would join in the joke making sessions, and he would be funny. And then he would do another one that was funny. And then he would do something that was absolutely vulgar. Sometimes funny, sometimes not, always shocking. And it was just one of the people on Twitter. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know anything about him. And then he sent me a private message that said, how am I doing? Am I doing okay? Which was very cute. And being the guy I am, I sent back a note that said, you're doing fine. You know, I would advise you to, you know, steer away from the vulgarity, but that's just me because I'm a prude. You know, do what you will. And he cut back a little bit on the vulgarity. And then he sent me a private message that said, hey, could I send you some stand-up material that I've written? And I said, sure, here's my email address. And he sent me a page and a half of shock value, pussy-eating, poop touching. I don't remember what it was. It was just hard.
Everybody's first time on stage material.
Exactly. Horrifically vulgar stand-up material. And I said, some of this is good. There's a lot of shock value in it. I would urge you, if you want to write and do comedy, to work on joke writing first, learn to write good jokes, and then figure out when you want to lean into vulgarity for the sake of shock value. And the next day, he sent me a page and a half of stand-up material that was not all shock value and had some really good jokes in it. And I said, there are some really good jokes here. You should keep doing this, and you should get out and start performing. And then he sent me a page and a half. Apparently a page and a half is his ideal length. an email that said, I can't go out and do stand-up. I'm agoraphobic. I haven't been out of my house in 10 years. I might be interested in writing some comedy. What do I do? And I said, well, I would suggest you start a blog of some sort, or a podcast, or, you know, find ways to get your material out into the world that will be comfortable for you. And he said in this long email about being agoraphobic, would you share this with Paul and Kelly? Because I feel very close to you guys. So I did. And Kelly was agoraphobic for a time. So they bonded on that level. And I said, you know, get it into the world. And then on Twitter, as a simple joke that I didn't understand right the first time I read it, he said, I'm going to California. Dylan Brody has invited me to stay on his neighbor's couch. And it took me a moment to realize that that was a very funny line. And I responded saying, if he didn't want me to invite people to stay on it, he shouldn't have put it out on the curb. And Darren sent me a private note that said, I think there's a podcast in this.
And there was. Said,
I have no idea what that means. What are you talking about? And he sent me a page and a half explaining to me what a podcast is. And I said, no, I understand what a podcast. I don't know what you're thinking of doing with this. And he had this premise. And his premise was, he had moved to L.A. because I invited him to stay on my neighbor's couch. It turns out the couch is out on the sidewalk. He interviews people who are coming to visit me at my home. He just grabs them on the way past.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me, my dog needs to be inside.
Oh, that's okay. I'm biting a cat off right here, too.
He is grabbing them before they can come visit me. And everybody but him seems to feel that I'm doing him a huge favor, while he realizes that he's homeless and living on a couch and just doesn't want to say it aloud. And I said, that's very funny. I think there's something there, by all means. And he said, can I use your name and call it Dylan Brody's Neighbor's Couch? And I said, what is it going to cost me? And he said, nothing, and I'll plug your CDs every show. And I said, done, because that's how I negotiate. And so he started this thing up. And at first he was going to script every show. And he had written a script for his first show with Paul Myers. And he was afraid it was going to run too long. And it wound up running, I think, 6 minutes total. And then he slowly realized that he could be a little looser and just interview people and
just chat,
have conversations and chat. And it turned into what it was. Now, through this, first of all, he had some amazing people on this show. Prevenza did the show. Roseanne Barr did the show. I believe you did the show.
Yeah, I did.
And he had a really good run with it for, I think, about a year, year and a half. Put a bunch of episodes out. And during this time, because he was socializing through this safe avenue, I think, he overcame the agoraphobia. And I started getting emails that said things like, I went shopping. I'm driving an hour away to see a comedy show. I'm thinking about getting a job.
What the?
Then at a certain point, he drove 10 hours to see me perform in Indianapolis with his son and a friend of theirs. And somehow he credits me and Kelly with curing his agoraphobia and helping him enormously, which is the silliest thing I can imagine, because literally all I did was say, what's this going to cost me?
And that's all it took, though. He just needed that.
He figured himself out and he got his shit together. And he is the sweetest. I'm talking to him this afternoon, actually. He's letting me rehearse my solo show at him over the phone. The solo show, by the way, which will be performed this Sunday at the Improv, May 3rd at 6 p.m. $5 at the door.
$5 value.
$5, big value. Big value at the Improv this Sunday. He's one of my three favorite people on the planet, I think, at this time. He's just an adorable, lovely human. And he got this podcast run going that was extraordinary.
Well, I hate that he stopped doing it. That was it. Just one day, he kind of like, I think I'm done. But there's so much that he could still be doing with it.
Yeah, he had made a deal with AmericasComedy.com to air them, to run them. And I'm not quite certain of what went on there. But as with all things, if you have a hobby, eventually you have to find a way to start dealing to support your hobby.
Right.
And eventually it becomes a commercialized enterprise, and then eventually it stops being fun.
Right.
And I can't blame, you know, he wasn't making anything on it. It was just, it was a great exercise in free speech and artistic freedom and self-exploration. And he was interested in comedy, and he got to really weirdly embed himself in the comedy community for a while.
In a good group. I mean, he was not just, he came into the big group.
Yeah. And he I think he had almost every writer from Everybody Loves Raymond on the show at some point. He had Fred Stoller on the show at some point. And he did it all fearlessly. There was never a moment when you heard one of those and went, he is out of his league.
Right.
It was just Darren Staley sitting on a couch outside Dylan's house talking to huge comedy acts.
Yeah. Which is a lot like this right now, as you can see. You're talking to somebody in a basement of a house and just over a Skype. So it's just amazing what technology can do today. That
we live in the future.
We are living in the future. And I'm probably at the point
– I fear that the future is on the wrong side of history.
Do you? No. I think we're moving in the right direction, that we're all communicating like this. We all can have a little show, and we're not dictated to by the media, like the big three anymore. Like, these are the three channels, and this is all you can hear, or this is all you can see. I think now with podcasts and the way we can do things, we are all kind of more together.
I do, too. I don't think it's broken through yet to the point at which a real vast disparity of ideas, a vast spectrum of ideas are being expressed to a really wide audience. But it started. This is, I think, still the golden age of podcasting, or just before the golden age of podcasting. I think there's going to come a point at which someone figures out how to really build a podcasting and the vast range of thought and possibility and get it to a really wide audience. You know, I don't know what your viewership is, but I doubt it's over a million.
No. Say I'm a couple of thousand if okay. That on a regular basis. Unlike Marin, who has you know, the millions, yeah, or so, or Adam Carolla, which does. But I think that's really good, because a lot of people don't even know what podcasting is. I have to tell my friends how to download an app or just click on, yeah, like they're not aware yet.
I think as it becomes more and more part of the cultural landscape, we may find that really big changes are happening, because ideas that have been expunged from the cultural conversation get to be explored in ways that they haven't been for centuries.
And more people are finding podcasts like not iTunes, TuneIn Radio they're picked up by Roku. And, you know, Roku now, everybody can get it on TV. So now, like, my podcast is on Roku because of that. Now, more people will discover that. As this grows, people will start to figure out where it is and how to find it, and it's going into more homes, and more gadgets, more devices are going to have it. So it's going to be a big market, I believe.
I think you are absolutely right on that. Does this get edited down to an hour?
No, I'm actually – typically it does, but I've enjoyed it so much, I'm going to run the entire thing. So
okay.
Because it's just been so much fun, and it's very enlightening. I think for people that listen, you've been a great guest as far as topics and a little acting technique, and we've got some auditioning technique, and it's been fun. But I think what I probably should do, because we're going on an hour 20, is let you promote yourself on how everybody can find you, all your stuff, websites.
I am happy to do it. Here we go.
Okay.
On Facebook, find The Dylan Brody. That's my fan page, and I need as many numbers on that as possible. So even if you don't like me, please go there and like me.
Just like him.
It's a click. It's not an emotional commitment. At Twitter, I am at Dylan Brody, DylanBrody. Mm-hmm. And I don't promise to lead you anywhere interesting, but I would like to be followed. My website is DylanBrody.com. You can sign up for my newsletter and always know where I'm performing and what's going on in my mind. It's once a month I send out a newsletter, maybe twice if I've got something big coming up. For instance, this Sunday, I will be at the Improv presenting my new solo show, Dylan Brody's Driving Hollywood. That's at 6 p.m. It's $5 at the door, and it's an over an hour of an amazing solo show, 6 p.m. May 3rd at the Improv. Also, 5 CDs from Stand Up Records, all available at Amazon as CDs or downloads, also available at iTunes. And over at Rooftop Comedy, you can get my latest full audio digital download, Dylan Goes Electric, and my hour-long solo show is a $5 download, More Arts, Less Marshall. That's at rooftopcomedy.com. My humor book, The Modern Depression Guidebook, available at authorium.com and, of course, Amazon. My kids' books, Young Adult Market, Tale of a Hero and the Song of Her Sword, and The Warm Hello is a science fiction novel, available at Amazon. And, of course, if you're a publisher, the rights to my new novel, Laughs Last, still available after the previous small publisher went out of business, comes pre-blurbed Carl Reiner, Paul Krasner, and Bud Friedman. Laughs Last, a wonderful family drama from Dylan Brody. How was that?
That was very good. That was great. And it lets everybody know, hey, this guy's legit.
Oh, I am not messing around. Stanley Drama Award winner, you know, for my play Mother May I. I can out pompous your most pompous. I can out pompous Dick Cavett.
Oh.
I can out pompous David Steinberg if challenged to do so.
What about Dennis Miller?
Dennis Miller isn't pompous, he's pretentious. Pomposity requires that you actually know the things you claim to know and believe the things you claim to believe. Well,
and your dog is verifying it too.
That's right.
Well, all right, Dylan. Hey, thanks for giving us your time here on the podcast. And I will promote this and get it out. And oh, look at that gorgeous dog wanting outside. And we will get this on the air and hope to get some more people there at your show at the Improv there on Melrose.
But you know when it is?
It's $5, right?
Yeah, you know when it is?
What's that?
It's May 3rd at 6 p.m.
May 3rd.
Improv on Melrose.
6 p.m. Melrose Improv.
Thank you very much, sir. It's been a joy and a delight.
It's been fun. Let's do it again sometime.
Call me any old time about any old thing, man.
Sounds good. Take care. See you, man. Dylan Brody, everybody.
In the basement of the mud flap house, flapping and poo, and they're underwear, thing raising noose, and poo licks herself, and flap contemplates manly things. He thinks about guns and trucks and stooges three, men and boys, and that doesn't sound right. He thinks about booze and bacon and power tools. Come with me, let your mask you leave. Oh, won't you come with me and